morning. This is the August 13th, 2025 Improvements Committee special meeting. It's special because we changed the date. Present are Director Jenko and me, myself, John Merchant. The first item is the call to order. We're done with that, right? And the second is comments from the public.
I do have public comments this morning, sir. Tony Velez.
Okay, Tony?
Okay. And I'll bring up your... I'll bring up your emails.
Yeah, that'd be good if you could do that. Thanks, Amelia. So this is an ongoing conversation that we've had regarding a couple of items, one of which is the easement request that we're asking for here off of Jackson Highway into the district drive out here. So if you could show that. We had talked about this before and trying to put something in place, and I think we're now done to the stage that we can submit it to the Improvements Committee. And obviously this is just for discussion, and you guys can take it up to the board from there.
Are you putting that up?
Yeah, if you can put it up.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Sorry.
No, that's fine.
It's coming. Tony, T-O-N-Y. I apologize. And I'm bringing them up in the order that you sent them over.
Okay, that's fine.
Here is this TV.
That's fine.
The 39 access? Okay, great. Shall I make it bigger? Is that good?
Yeah, it should be good.
Okay.
I've got Mike Robertson here with me. He's our civil engineer that's created all the drawings and everything for us. So I'll let him speak.
Before, when we presented this, we had a potential development, but that's off the table now.
Yep.
But the property still wants access to get up to the signal here, because right now we do have access onto Highway 16, but it's a right in, right out only, and which will be still utilized with Caltrans. But you can't make U-turns at the signal, so access to the signal will be important for the project, and the project will be down the road. So we're just asking now, just concept, to get an easement that goes from the property through north of the solar field, and just to get access to the signal. And if anything happens down the road, we'll of course come back to the committee for the potential, whenever there's a potential development here. So we just want not just to get the easement at this stage, and then we'll just still allow eventually for development to occur. That's all we're asking for at this time.
Yep. So that's item number one. And item number two.
Ready for the next?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
No, that's better.
Sewer easement, exhibit B,
Yeah.
Which one?
This is the exhibit.
The exhibit VB?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's probably the wrong one.
Probably the document.
Oh, okay.
Is that it?
Yep, so that's it.
This was also previously presented. It's an easement that goes through the Jenko property, and those are again quick claims. So the project needs a sewer easement that would go around the property for future force main. So we highlighted it in red. That would completely stay off of the Jenko property, but it would be on the golf course property and go on down and tie into the CSD property that's by the lift station. So this is just a presentation to show there's an alignment intent, and this will be also on the sort of on legal descriptions that we provide to present to the CSD for review. This This does show up in our sewer report, which is being submitted to the CSB any day. This one, get in front of the committee to show that we will be requesting a CSD easement to connect property from Hope Village B to the sewer location. Well, just for information purposes at this time.
Would you like to see the next slide, sir?
Nope, that was it.
Yeah, the next slide is the legal description, and it's related, but that'll be a package that gets sent to the CSD.
Yeah, it's just a document for now.
And I'll still add all of these documents to public comment on the internet, okay?
Is all of that easement on your property?
Yes.
Including the Bridge House Lane section that goes through the street, and that is also on your property?
Yeah. It'll be right, on that westerly end, it'll be right adjacent to your property, but it's all on the Belfort property in its entirety.
How does this jive with the pedestrian path that supposedly goes along that same alignment? If there's a sewer line, should be a problem with there being a pedestrian path there?
Shouldn't be. That exact alignment, I would want the Domenichelli to review it also, and Eric to, for the exact alignment of their views. I'm sure there's going to be something in the way. Never fails.
But it's now completely on golf course property, correct?
100%.
And so there's no future issue if the club would change ownership?
No, that's why we're going to want the easement. Now to get it out of the way, if the club changes ownership, who's going to have the easement there?
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, so if it does change hands and there's an easement in place, the easement would still be part of the sale. It goes across as like the deed item. The easement would always be there. Domenichelli and Associates have already reviewed this. There's not very many comments to the alignment other than that they're potentially, with the expanded amount of sewer that would be coming from this, that 6B, the line, would need upsized. And we're currently in the process with a project to find a line that was placed there years ago. There's a 10-inch line that's supposed to be somewhere near 6B. And so we're going to try to locate that with some of our CIP to help this development. But the alignment for this is a lot better with what's being proposed today.
Yeah, staying with this one, because I want to go back to 39 acres when we're done here. This is essentially what we asked for, correct?
Exactly, right. It puts it basically in what's a public right-of-way where the property, really, if it changes hands, the essential use of the property is probably not going to change hands, meaning it would stay that. A pedestrian pathway would not be a problem for us. I've seen, actually, lines placed directly under pedestrian pathways. In other places, it actually kind of protects them like a roadway does, and it also gives you the ability to have access and see them and view the line and make sure that everything's working. It also gives you something to drive on to view it, and so that wouldn't be a problem, because that was one of the questions. That wouldn't be a problem if it went under or near a pathway. It shouldn't be an issue.
So on the map, Randy, is this the part of this that crosses the pedestrian path? I'm not sure where that is or what we're talking about there.
Is it later when it gets built towards the far end, the far reach, I thought? Or is it along that?
When you say the pedestrian path.
The pedestrian path that we've got that's going towards the wooden bridge.
It's not even hitting that. So.
Yeah, no. That the alignment is fine the way it is.
Okay. So, can we back up a minute to the 39 acres?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was not on the board, but I was in the audience when you guys presented this the first time. And I saw something from Eric that that Joe already had a work drawings on this? Is that true?
I'm not sure. 100%, I can't speak to that. I know that it's been brought up previously, but it was really, most of that was prior to me. That 39 acres, I could share my opinion about that 39 acres. I do have some concern with any type of development there because it sits so close to a wastewater treatment facility that most likely that poses the district a large risk for liability as we go on down the road, especially if it's residential. Because when residences are placed that close to a sewer plant, typically there becomes some legal activity, lawsuits over odors and various things. And so that would be my largest concern about that area. But the easement itself, I don't have a lot of comment on, other than it could pose problems with traffic and with semis and stuff that we get deliveries on, because if they make a right onto that and they're trying to make a right immediately and somebody's trying to turn left out into what is our current driveway, it could be a little dicey or risky for a large semi that's delivering chemicals and stuff. But I haven't seen enough of it to give a full statement to the board on it. And Domenichelli, I haven't seen any work on them from it. I was waiting more for the board to see if we wanted to have them take a look at it and what was being proposed.
So is this now out of the county plan?
That's correct.
It's completely out.
Correct.
So the total on the application down there is reduced by the number of apartments and residences that were planned, the 88 and the 160, whatever that number was. Are those out?
Those are out.
Yeah, okay.
That was a vicious sketch to see what could happen. What happened on the previous presentation, we had an alignment went south of the solar field, basically following the existing roads that are out there. And there was a conversation, and Mimi had mentioned it, other people mentioned it, maybe put it on the north of the solar field, and that was the consensus. That's kind of what we did. So, but down the road, whenever something's going to happen, there's going to be complete improvements on the intersection. That'll be down the road.
Yeah, that's already in the traffic plan that's down there. You guys are responsible for the intersection, whether we put in an easement or not.
Exactly. Yeah. So it would be. All we're looking for is the ability to get to the signal, and that it just is that it adds incentive for some kind of development. What that is, we don't know.
Yes. Well, one thing's convenient, because you'll hear in a little bit when we analyze this that the water for that 39 acres is not in the plan. It's just not in there. Randy, you had some discussions on this last time about, number one, why we should do it, and number two, what it was worth.
I don't really see a problem. It's to me, it makes sense that they need access to the signal for that property sometime in the future beyond my lifetime. Something will happen. To do it now or to do it later, I can't imagine why we would have a problem giving them access to the traffic signal. It's a public traffic signal. And it doesn't, there's no disadvantage to us to putting access through there. So I don't have a problem with this, but what's your time frame as far as wanting to actually put this in place?
It'd be nice just to get the easement out of the way, and the verbiage could be put in that easement to allow the future alignment that's subject to the CSD approval. But we'd like to get a document in place, put it together, get it in front of you so you can go by your attorney and make sure that the verbiage is right, just to get the legal access out of the way.
How about a change in zoning to restrict it to non-residential use?
Well, that would be a zoning change, and that's not in the plan right now.
I know it's not in the plan, but our concern with giving you an easement and inheriting future or present residential development in there, there's nothing but headaches in that for us.
Well, that would have to be done with the application itself.
Could you?
CSD's got to, enroll in any application anyway, just for
I don't want to fight it down there. I want to work it out before it gets down there.
And those submittals would happen going through also through the Rancho Murrieta, just like we've been doing all along. Every development out here, we always go through the CSD.
Yeah, I understand that. But like I said, my concern with it, number one, would be the water that's necessary to support what was last time 160 apartments and 88 residential units. And number two is, like Eric mentioned, it's, you know, like growth meeting an airport. I mean, yeah. It's always fine until the growth gets there, and then it's a nonstop problem. And
yeah.
I mean, we facilitate that granting an easement. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for some kind of a concession or...
That would probably have to be discussed between all of us before we do that.
Okay, so, well...
I mean, it's a thought, and we'll consider it.
And, also, I'm always of the opinion that the CSD is here to support, you know, development with it. It's got some with the rationale to it.
Yeah.
You're here to provide sewer, water, and drainage. And, I mean, words of, someone's going to take a stab at it and have an idea on the project. Whatever that is, we don't know what that is. So
yeah.
It's just not, we're not doing it.
Okay. Do you want, hold on a sec. They're separate entities, so do we want to move them both forward to the board individually?
I think, yeah, they're separate. They're separate issues, so they should move forward separately.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll add both of these items to the board agenda. You know what, though? I haven't seen the easement for the, for Randy's property yet. Are you preparing that?
What do you mean?
On the previous one?
Uh-huh.
That got abandoned.
Yeah.
Say it again?
That got abandoned.
The easement through the property got a quick claim.
Yeah. And you've already done that, but
the CSD did that.
Yeah. We did it. Yeah. Didn't we amend ordinance resolution? It's one or the other.
Right.
Didn't we?
I need to follow up with Patrick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You quick claimed that easement, right?
Yeah.
I suggest that you make sure to get it recorded.
Yeah, right.
That's what,
right.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's on the CSD.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll figure that out before we get to the meeting.
Okay. Then I'll move both of these items.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. I do have one more public comment if you're ready, sir. Richard Gears.
Sure.
First of all, I have to say that was a lot of discussion without it being on the agenda.
That's true.
And I'm sorry for them that they don't have access to their property, but that's not our problem. And I don't see why giving them an easement for some future thing, why bother? And first of all, what's in it for us? Without giving them an easement with nothing in it for us, that sounds like a gift of public funds. They're getting a benefit, something that's worth something to us, giving it to them. And it's certainly going to degrade access to the CSE building. So I don't get it. Why? That's all I have to say.
Okay. Anything else on this?
No, sir.
Yeah, we need to get these agendized in the future so we don't go through this whole thing on public comment.
Yeah, so like 7 days before the meeting is when we have to bring it to Eric to see if we can add an agenda item. Thank you.
Okay, item three, improvement staff report.
All right, so first off, we have Basin 5. Also, has the terminology for it has been used as Lost Lake in the past. This was to add a new fountain. We did place two fountains back into service in this area, I believe it was probably 4 or 5 months ago, maybe six. And so this was to bring another one in and place this in there. And we've already done the work with RMA, because RMA is the provider for the electric. So we had conversations with them. They are okay with us installing a third fountain into this area, and so this is a quote to have that fountain purchased and installed there. And so this is an action item that would go to the board. It's open for discussion here to see if we want to move it forward to the board to purchase and install.
Randy?
This is a third fountain?
Yes, correct.
And someone decided that a third fountain is going to make a difference, or are we doing something here to make people happy because we're doing something?
The first two have aided in the water quality and the appearance. And so the third one is a stagnant zone because it's kind of shaped like an L in that basin. And so there is still an area that's stagnant that could have water quality issues, dissolved oxygen, other issues like that. So I would say it's both. It doesn't improve the appearance, but it also does help what we will then at some point discharge to the river. Because when that basin gets high enough, it overflows and goes to the river. So better water quality will also be a part of this delivered by this fountain. Ensuring that they stay functional and operational is also important, and that's what happened in the past is the mixers and the fountains became non-operational, and so the water quality degraded quite a bit out there. And so, yes, this is looked at as aiding in both appearance and water quality.
It's a minimal amount,
and
I think as long as we think it's going to improve it, I think we ought to just move this to the board and do it.
Yeah. Let's. You want to then move it and recommend approval? Yeah, I agree.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, Eric.
All right. So moving on to. We'll call 3B, the Integrated Water Master Plan Work Group Report. So I'm going to kind of turn it over to the community members that really helped us on this. Basically what this is to tie up a lot of the questions that were asked, not only by board members, but by the community. We went through the IWMP, looked at how a lot of the information was put together, what information was used, as well as looking at what's required by State Water Resources Control Board when you produce a integrated water master plan and how it should be done. We did try to wrap up a lot of the questions that were being asked of the consultants. And so some of those questions were really from data that the district itself produced. And so the feeling isn't really necessarily that the report that was produced was due to workmanship issues, but much more in the sense that there wasn't a lot of feedback from the district itself on how it should be done, how it should look like, what we should be using and looking like. And so this work group took on a lot of that to close up a lot of those answers. And also, there were a lot more questions that we were left with. So the conclusion kind of is that we still needed a consultant to step in and help wrap up the integrated water master plan, because there still are some unanswered questions and some data that needs to be reworked in a different format and done differently so that we have good numbers for what we would look like during a severe drought, when we would potentially run out of water. And some of those questions are left into this, but I'll kind of turn it over to Jim, who was instrumental in kind of writing our, like, an executive summary for this. And so, Jim, if you want, you're more than ready to step up and speak, unless I think that's probably better than having questions from.
You want to start, or I can, or you want to do that? I think, first of all, collectively, the people that worked on this have about 40 or 45 years of experience with this, going all the way back to when Janice first expressed concerns with the 2006 report. I kind of got involved in this in 2010, and I think one of the things that still concerns me most of all is when you look, for example, at the results of the 2010 report, and then you look at the results of what is being presented in the Mattis report, and then subsequently in the analysis that this working group did, I'm still befuddled at how it was possible to justify a development in a quantity which in 2010 was pretty similar to what we were talking about when we started this process. And there are explanations for that. And I think we tried to deal with those. One of the things that I think is important to recognize that there is general consistency with demand numbers. What Lisa says is the demand, and what we looked at as the demand as we did the stress test analysis that you'll see in the report. It's important to note that the highest demand the district had to this point was in 2007, which is where the district reached a demand of 1,801 acre-feet. Prior to the 2010 report and prior to the magical 2020 reductions that we were going to experience, and prior to the generation of enough recycled water that, when combined with a 50% conservation rate, gave us enough water to support development. What we found in the report was that the number that was used by Mattis, particularly in recycled water, which is about 907 acre feet, was way overstated. And you can look simply at an analysis of, if you were to, for example, take a per capita number of 2.5 people in a household, and if you were to look at 535 units, which is roughly the number of A, B, C, and H in the new development, and assume that on an urban standard you would get 40 gallons per day. Even if you do the arithmetic on those numbers, you only generate 60 acre feet of water. I mean, the majority of water that we use is outside the system that will provide recycled water. And it didn't make any sense where Mattis simply told us that, oh, the rest of it is made up in commercial development, because commercial development, as I understand it here, will not support another 300 acre feet of water, because it simply doesn't exist. The chances of it existing in an industry that's going to use that much water is unrealistic. The report, it makes a statement in the beginning about risk and the labeling of our system as high risk. And that statement was made by Lisa Mattis herself. But I think one of the concerns we had going through the report was that the report in itself, as it establishes levels of conservation and levels of evaporation and levels of seepage, does not really extend itself to what is the worst case scenario. And unfortunately, where the data cuts off at 2022 in this report, 2024 was a monumental year in terms of heat and evaporation, and the 52 days over 100 degrees and the 10 days at 104 plus degrees that we experienced, that showed us as we did the analysis that there was a very significant loss of water to evaporation, when coupled with the fact that we're already dealing with reservoirs that in 2010 and 26 were purported to hold more water than what we can really store. They also incorporate, particularly in 2010, the use of Lake Clementia, which pretty much is understood to be a source of last resort, and since that time has been integrated into an ordinance that makes it simply a source of emergency supply and not available for development. One thing that is not paid attention to in the report is the degradation of water quality that comes with the reduction of reservoirs. And in almost all the cases, historically and in this case, we are talking about situations where you're running reservoirs dry. And in light of what's happening at the present time in Clementia, I simply would ask the question that what's the impact of that degradation on the other two lakes as we start taking those lakes to 50, 40, 30, and 20%, and ultimately, in some cases, perhaps to dead storage. So we talked about a lot of this. We spent a lot of time. Jim did a fantastic job of categorizing, you know, in the back 6 or 7 pages of the report, the differences in data that we said we would look at as a primary function of the report. And when you reconcile that against the stress test that you'll see on the third page, it simply tells you that when we hit a sustained and particularly a drought that lasts over the period of 1 year, we are in a hell of a lot of trouble. The numbers speak for themselves. You can debate those numbers if you want, but starting with Lisa's report that advertises trouble and ending in this analysis, which increases the amount of trouble we get in, needless to say, in a drought we're in trouble. And I think that one of the things that's lacking in there that would be picked up in an urban plan is we have absolutely no systematic plan to control a drought and to reduce usage. And the numbers that are presented in the Mattis report are so out of kilter that we pointed out originally in other discussions that last year, in that heat wave, those 52 days, okay, we were, by the second month, we were in a stage 5 critical shortage. And if that's the case, we should have been doing something, and we weren't, because we don't know what it is to do, and we don't know really at this point in time what that critical shortage is. And consistent with doing anything, I think one of the high priorities and something that would come out in a strategic plan is we need a drought conservation plan, and we need a good one. So I can't say enough about the work that this group did and the people that participated in it. I mean, we spent a lot of time on this, and I think the end result of this is one of the things in all the years that I've been floating around this place that I am most proud of, and it is the culmination for me of 16 years of concern, and for Janice probably about 25 or 30 years of concern that our water supply as it sits would not support future development. So with that, I really would like any comments the three of you have. Jim, Janice, anything?
No, well.
Come on up to the front. Yeah.
Not really prepared to do any kind of a presentation or anything like that. That was not the expectation here. I thought we were going to be here just answering any questions that might be.
Yeah, and we will do more at the yeah. meeting.
But with that being said, I know it's always a dangerous assumption to assume that everybody's kind of read the report and gone through it. And so I just highlight for quickly as I can, and maybe it'll stimulate any questions that might come up, you know, what we looked at. And you can see in the report, we outline on the first, on page 4-2, the different issues that we looked at. Many of them were like data types of issues, things that had come up over the conversation. Different ideas that had come up. The whole issue of Clementia comes up, the water cycling, recycling issue. We looked into all of those, these things that are bulleted out on page 4-2. And then at the end of the day, we said, you know, so what? You know, so we've done all this. What does it mean? Where do we go? How do we move this plan forward? And so we thought we wanted to lay out what we thought were kind of the guiding principles and maybe next steps as we advance this plan. Because the plan does need to be advanced, and we can't dance around with this thing forever. And so we start out with the notion of, you know, look, the historic drought thing that's outlined in the plan, that's a good test. I mean, it says, look, you got 2 years back-to-back summers where you haven't been able to pump water out of that river for 19 months. And so how are you going to survive that? And that is a reasonable test. It's real. So we looked at, although when we looked at that test, that raised questions in our mind. Well, what are some of these underlying assumptions that have significant impact on the amount of water that we're talking about here? Like, how much are we losing to evaporation? How much are we losing to seepage? What is lost through non-revenue water? You know, the leaks and the seeps and, you know, the maintenance and the production of the water itself. You know, what are the numbers? Because the reports, as you look into them, and as you go back and look at other ones, those numbers are moving around. And it's like, you know, I think, you know, as a community, as a board, we should know these are the numbers that we're using for those kinds of things. Because when you add those numbers up, it can be up to 50% of the value of the water that you're looking at here, especially when you throw in that 10% factor for the climate change and outdoor use, which I remember a meeting where, right, Randy, you said, hey, you know, that sounds a little high to me. Well, maybe it is high. I don't know. We should talk about that, though. Is the study says 10%. Is that what we're going to use, or aren't we going to use it? Should be 8%. You know, I don't know. We should have a decision on that for going forward. So that is, then the other thing was, you know, really with the approvals last November for the Riverside and the residencies, you know, we have, you know, right now the way the plan is put together, it's kind of like, well, here's today and here's the future. And, you know, that's not the reality that we're facing here in this community. What we have is we have 350 some odd homes that have been approved. We have obligated ourselves to provide them water. So we should have the data specific for what is the requirement for us to meet that obligated group that we've given will serve letters to. And, you know, I had requested that data way back in May of last year. Actually, Bob Kyle made a request for that information in July. And yet there's nothing been done with that. We should know specifically what is the obligation that we have, what is the water shortage that we have for that group. We know we have a shortage. How much? How big is it? And I don't understand why that hasn't been calculated. There's no reason why it shouldn't be calculated. If we're going to go out and start drilling wells, it seems to me like we should know how much water we're trying to find, you know, to get rid of that shortage. And then we need to look at the full build-out as well. You know, and I think it would be good for the CSD to understand the difference between where we are today with the obligated group and the full build-out, because if you're going to try to provide water for both of those, somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have to pay for that. And understanding the differences and what it takes to provide the water for this versus that will help you as you begin to figure out, you know, who's going to pay for this and how's it going to get financed. The other concern that we had, and this really kind of went back from looking at some of the earlier reports, is that while the state's plans say, you know, you have to kind of have this conservation plans that say you'll reduce your water down to 50% during a period of drought, that doesn't mean that, you know, you should be using that number for strategic planning purposes. That's just saying that's how you handle an emergency. You can pick any of the different number for, you know, how low do you want it to go. You take a look at the original Gibbertson report that was done in this whole thing, and, you know, he points out some of these different communities where they had goals like, I think it was Calaveras County says, well, we're going to make sure that we have enough water that 100% of the time we're never going to have to you fall into a conservation mode. You know, we're going to plan to have that much water. Now, of course, if they have a drought, they may still have to go down to the 50%, but that's their plan isn't built around that. You know, their water supply isn't built around that. And so I think, you know, we shouldn't be confusing mandatory drought curtailments with strategic planning for how much water do we need. They're not the same thing. Risk-averse assumptions. You know, obviously the priority for getting some additional water in here from different source of water supply. The whole issue of Clementia, which has been already just talked about. Here's another one, the next one at the top bullet on page 7. I was mostly interested in this plan as, you know, as a current plan. But as we've gotten into this and got involved with this committee, it was almost required that we had to go and look back at previous plans. There's just so many people that had all these concerns and issues. Well, this plan said that, this one said that, none of that ever came true. And you know what? It's right. They're right. You know, there are a lot of things that have been assumptions. There's even a water assessment sitting down at the county right now that is full of things that just aren't true. You know, that, and, you know, in terms of the amount of water that we're going to have from recycling, we'd have zero. We've basically zero through the recycling. Yet down at the county, we're saying we have 1,100 acre feet of recycled water, and 560 of it's going to offset residential sprinkling, and 550 of it's going to the golf course. That's not true. And that's 10 years old. That's 10 years from now. If that county report says, hey, you know what? The CSD has made a plan. They're going to drill two wells, and they're going to find, they found one well that's got 500 gallons per minute that's available. They think there's two of them, and they really only need one. Where's the well? You know, so that's the next point. I don't think we should approve any plan until it's a fact that these things exist. Until it's a fact that recycled waters exist and it is replacing potable water. It's a fact that we have a well. You know, it's 10 years. Think about that, 10 years. And think about the position of these developers. They're sitting here reading this thing, oh, great, great, we got all kind of water. And here we are 10 years later now, there ain't no water. No wonder people are upset. You know, so I guess that would be the, and I guess that gets to the last point I'd want to make here now, is that just gets to the whole thing, is that I just think calling this thing an integrated water master plan if it's not a misnomer, it's a bad joke. It is not a plan. It's only a study. It's only an assessment. It's not a plan until you as a board pick the priorities, set out the action plans, put realistic timelines and measurements on those things, figure out how the heck you're going to finance it, then it's a plan. So that would be my last point.
One of the, Janice, come on, if you're, no, Janice is.
Hi, I've been coming in front of this board since 2006, as you all know. I feel like the little gnat that has irritated everybody for years. And the reason I did was in 2006, I discovered the difference in the studies. And we started at 1,800 dwelling units that this water supply could support without making any changes to our water supply. It went up to, I believe it was over 5,400, and then even in some of the studies, doesn't even state how many homes can be supported because the engineers know it can't happen. It's ludicrous. It's been because they've been changing assumptions along the way. They've been putting in assumptions that are false, like the recycled water. There's no recycled water. The early studies said there would not be recycled water for development. But you get further down, then there's, 955 acre feet of water for development. That recycled water doesn't exist. The same thing like Jim was saying. We have to have facts. We have to have water that exists. It can't be we're assuming that this we can do this, but we're pulling it from air. That's why I've been fighting so hard. That's why I've been running around trying to get everybody's attention, and why I've driven myself and my husband crazy, is because we have to base the future on the facts. I mean, I'm not anti-development, and I'm not anti the developers that are in this room and that have fought so hard, and I get where they're coming from. But none of us can survive if we don't have water, and our property values will be non-existent if we don't have water. This needs to be a plan, and a plan, if you notice, if you read the Integrated Water Master Plan, you will find that it talks about the loss of water or the reduction of water for drought conservation. It doesn't have a trigger point. It doesn't say this is when that water is turned off on your exterior. It's not in there, and the reason being is I think they started at the very beginning when you wouldn't be turning the water off to show that we have more than we actually do. Like I said, it doesn't say how many homes can be safely supported by our water supply. It's because they know they can't support the numbers the way the study's written. let's get a plan in place that says, yes, we can realistically do this. This is the water we actually have. And let's build a community based on the facts and the truth and not playing games where everyone gets in trouble. Thank you.
One last comment that is to somewhat substantiate what Jim said. One of the real issues of concern for me going back years is that we have continued to use conservation as a planning tool. And when you look at the conclusions of the 2010 report, just two or three sentences that I want to read to you that really highlight the discrepancies between the decades, if you want to call it that. Based on the scenario with water supply that reflects three consecutive driest water years on record, 96, 76, 77, 78, compliance with 2020 use targets, that's debatable, and medium growth build-out, which is where in the last go-around at least we were offered alternatives to select from as mitigation sources. The following conclusions can be made. There is no estimated shortfall when demands are curtailed by a 50% compounded reduction. Okay? So basically what the conclusion of that report was that if I give half of my water to Tony, he can build a house. However, it says, as a caveat to this, Clementia would be used, and it was only in this decade's report, okay, that we got to the point where we dug into permit analysis. That was done by the community, not by the CSD. And we found out basically for a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, we don't even have a permit. Okay, we don't have a permit to use Clementia in the way that is described in the 2010 report. We don't have a permit to use recycled water for residential use. We have a specific permit from the early 1980s that restricts the use of recycled water to golf courses, to parks, and at the time, the old RMA maintenance yard. Those are the only three places that allow the use of recycled water. We know that why we've put purple pipe in place, okay? We understand that even if we had a permit to use it down in Murrieta Gardens, that you would have to build a tank to settle the chlorine and before you could put that water onto residential landscaping to control the chlorine, just like they do up in Serrano. Serrano has a staff because no one in the community is allowed to touch their emitters. It's all done by whatever their version of the city or the CSD is up there. So that's kind of where we went with this. And I agree with Janice. I've never been, and I've never once said that I was against development in this community. I'm not. I think that a lot of the problems that we have and a lot of the problems going forward are revenue problems and infrastructure problems and reserve problems that are solved by reasonable development. But until we get a secondary source of supply, there just isn't water to do that. And my last concern is, and it may be just that I simply can't believe it or get my hands around it or understand it, if you drill into the ground and in 300 feet water starts coming out, that doesn't mean that we now have water for development. How many wells does it take? Where are the wells? Are the wells on our property? Are we leasing property? Are we buying property? How are we delivering that to a processing treatment facility? Are we building one next to it? That's what Atkins says we might do if we want to spend $40 million. Or do we move that water back over to the water plant? And what does that cost? And above all, with all of this stuff, secondary sources, infrastructure required, recycled water deliverability to residential units. Who pays for that? So if there are questions, let's have them. Amelia, anything?
I only have one from Gail.
Well, okay, and then Richard's going to bring you something.
All right, you can stay there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just
Randy, do you have anything either?
I'll defer to the chairman, I guess. He wants to...
No. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You're running it.
Okay, let's do the... And then we'll...
Comment before.
Okay, sure, go ahead.
You brought up something that I just wanted to share with Randy, because I think you were talking about in the 2010 study where they kind of said, hey, you know, if we use it for the 40% curtailment in the event of a drought, you know, we have a 690 acre feet shortfall. Okay, it's in the court. But if we use 50% curtailment, that goes away. We don't have a shortfall. Okay, so you kind of, well, that's pretty interesting. So you can, from a board risk planning standpoint, you know, how do you want to read that? You know, and then it goes on with the part that I thought was really interesting too, though, is then it goes on to say, you know, we think it would be kind of handy if you guys thought about finding maybe about 300 acre feet of contingency storage. And they aren't saying we're short. They're not saying it's a shortfall. Well, why don't you get a little 300 acre feet of contingency storage somewhere? You know? And then they go on further. And then the next paragraph goes on to say, hey, and you know, while you're at it, because of economies of scale, maybe you ought to consider getting 600 acre feet of contingency storage. Now, I don't know how you want to read that, but if I'm reading it as a board member, a risk making risk averse assumptions, I'm saying it sounds like we got 695 acre feet of shortfall, and they're telling us we need another 600 acre feet of contingency storage. That sounds like 1,200 acre feet of shortage to me. So it depends on how you want to read it.
Okay, then let's take the questions, and then we'll go back to Randy.
Okay.
When the county asks for a water supply assessment after Rancho North finishes their application, how will this document play into it? Will the county take credence of this document as much as the draft integrated water master plan? One thing that you said that I didn't pick up from skimming the report, and it was probably in there, but kind of one of your next steps would be to hire a consultant to finalize the integrated water master plan in light of this report.
Let me, first of all, I think if we produce another document, and we're one way or the other, it's irrelevant to this analysis, because once we get another 75 units, we're going to be in a phase where we have to do an urban plan. We'll probably have a year to do it.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to say you know bring it. We need it by next Tuesday, but we're going to have to do that plan. The water supply assessment is a different animal in that it is specifically detailed as to its content and as to its purpose by water code. And we have a letter from the county at CSD. It was a negotiation we had back when Tom Hennig was the general manager, that the county would not ask for us to provide a water supply assessment until such time as the application for the developer was complete. Okay, that doesn't mean, and it would be worthy of some serious thought, that the developer should complete the application and immediately run down and say, we want a water supply assessment. Because what we have in front of us, okay, is data from a working group report, from a draft analysis of a water plan by Lisa Mattis, And there's nothing in those two reports that gives us any flexibility whatsoever to tell the county, and we're responsible for preparing the water supply assessment. There's nothing in there that allows us to tell the county that we have water to support this development. So I think rationally the thing to do here is to spend the time trying to identify, test, and deliver a secondary source of water, whether it be in the ground, it be, you know, and we've had these cursory discussions with the Anatolia thing and the El Dorado irrigation thing that don't look like they're compatible. El Dorado for different reasons than Anatolia. And there are permits behind all of that as well. So where does it come from? I think logically the first thing to do is to figure out where we're going to put wells and how we're going to test them and what, you know, I don't have that engineering expertise. But what I will say personally is I'm looking at this secondary support as a bank, okay? If I'm saving money for Christmas, I want that money there in August, okay? I'm not going to say, well, I'm going to buy that stuff on Amazon tomorrow because I know I'm going to get money by Christmas. I'm not doing that. I'm gonna personally, and there are five people here, but I'm not doing anything unless that water's in the bank, unless I can see it, breathe it, touch it. No, because if we drill one well and that well goes dry, then what do? Do we dig another one, or do we do two at one time, or be real safe? Do we dig five at one time? Does it take five to convince everybody that that's enough water? I don't have these answers. So when you look at some of the stuff we've talked to WSC about, and we look at the original plan that we did when we had the hydraulic analysis done, the well drilling analysis. I mean, those have to be put together and combined with these reports to find out what we come up with. That's I think where we are, in my opinion anyway.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Richard Gears.
I think this looks good. I just have one little question. I was wondering why the water supply was being calculated without flashboards. I don't have a problem with that. I just, intuitively, I wouldn't have done it that way, but hearing that you did, I can sort of understand why, but I'd actually like to hear from the people who made the decision why.
I'll tell you, and I'm pretty confident we came pretty much to universal acceptance among ourselves as to why we should or shouldn't use flashboards or do other things in the report as well. Flashboards have been a reliable source of bringing our reservoirs up 2 feet, and it generates X amount of water. Okay, which I can't use the analogy I want to use, but it gets you a little bit more water. And one of the things it also does, if you mandate that we use them and you run across a February, March, April condition, okay, where you can't use them or you're told to take them out for whatever reason, late rain, who knows, mm-hmm. Okay, by using them and counting them completely, you magnify the impact of that mistake. Okay, if there is a year and you know the accident happens where you get lack of flashboard capacity and then you run headlong into a drought, you've magnified the risk. So part of what we tried to do in this risk analysis that what Jim is talking about is to minimize that risk. We can't tell if the river's going to run or it's not going to run. We tried to minimize the risk. And minimizing the risk, the best we can do is to not step out and say, well, 13 out of 15 years we can use flashboards, so we'll use them forever. I mean, that's my explanation of the rationale. And go ahead.
Yeah, also, it's not allowed to be used. State Water Resources Control Board and DWR states in the fact that you cannot use flashboards as part of your water assumption because it's beyond the capacity of what you would consider normal, because it goes beyond 100% of what your water is. And so they actually, you're not allowed to use it in your assumption. And part of that is because you're supposed to be stress testing against years that would be less than normal, right? It's not super common that you have like a really wet year where you can bank water and then all of a sudden turn around and have a drought that would impact you. The drought would be probably, you know, less than 2 years away because it'd be following that, but it's just not allowed. And so that's why it was removed, because the splashboards, you're not supposed to consider that volume.
Okay, that's helpful to know. I came up with an explanation, basically what you were saying. So, you know, I'm not objecting to it. Okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
That doesn't happen often, Richard. Any other public comments? Randy, I'm sorry, but I skipped ahead.
Just a couple thoughts. Maddox's study is already wrong because of things have changed since then, and you've changed some of their assumptions. You've changed some of the analysis of how they do it. I know enough about this that I could do a similar revision using the assumptions and analysis that I feel is appropriate. I don't know what it all means. I'm an engineer. I try and look at things analytically to solve problems. We could come up with three different studies. I tend to go back to the engineers and the experts' assumptions and analysis. But be that as it may, Jim put it exactly right. At the end of the day, where are we going with this? To my mind, all we really want out of this is, okay, so we know under any study we don't have enough water. How much more water do we need? And how do we get there? And I don't think we're making any progress on that. No matter what the number is that we need, what are we doing to solve the problem? And that's my take on the whole 45-minute conversation.
Yeah, and I can provide you one update. WSC and I meet today for a kickoff meeting for the groundwater well siting study. So that is moving forward. We will start today, and then we'll start transferring data over to them from the previous studies, the groundwater studies that were done in the past, mainly the Dunn report. And they've already started to work on that with their hydrology department. And so that program should be moving forward pretty quickly.
How do we, back to Jim's thing, they got to know how much water we need.
So,
how do we get there?
So I can tell you that what most systems are using these days to do that is what's called conjunctive use, meaning you should be able to supply the system off one source or the other. And the reason it's done that way is because, so in the past when the district looked for one well, that's great until your one well pump, you know, the pump itself fails or the motor fails. And so if it's up to me, you're going to be looking for sources that meet full demand on one or the other. Currently, we are fully reliant on a water plant that's tied to one leg of a distribution system. If there was a failure in operation of the plant itself or in that line, this community would be without water. And so it's going to be a multitude of wells. It's not going to be a well. A well will help lower the risk and up the resiliency. But until you have numerous sources, basically just like you would with a retirement fund and diversification, you want your risk to go down and that resiliency to go up as far as possible. And
I get all that.
Right. Well, full demand in the summer is about 3.5 million gallons a day. So the wells would need to be able to deliver that. Volume acre feet wise, you would want your wells to be able to deliver as many acre feet as you store. And so if you're looking at 1,800 acre feet, you would want wells that are at least capable to produce 1,800 acre feet in a year, just in case something happened. And that could be, it could be two wells, it could be three wells. It really depends on the study and then what they find in each hole. And that's why they do test drills, is to see the production capability of that. And typically the way agencies do it is wet years, you're using your surface water because you know you're going to be fine. And in dry years, you're using that groundwater to augment so that if you ran into a 2 or 3 year scenario, you can get by.
So that's a completely different analysis than this of how much water we need. What are we doing this for?
By this, which are we referring to? I just want to make sure that I'm answering.
I'm talking about the water, the integrated
the responses
water
to it.
Master plan.
There were a lot of things in there that were not feasible, and I'll specifically.
No. You just did an analysis on how we figure out how much water we need based on how much water we're using per day and how much water is storable, completely separate from the analysis here and the
I would actually
bottom
say,
line.
I would say that's not true, because the analysis points out the same factors except for they use different things to make up that water that, like I said, are not feasible. And what they did to try to do that was they tried to use recycled water that has no delivery system to communities to offset potable water usage. They also tried to use Clementia, which is not permitted, to do the same thing. And so I think you're getting the same exact answer from me, because even at the end of their study, Lisa Madhouse, when she was here, highlighted the fact that this community is high risk and very low resiliency because we have one source of water. And so I think even if you follow what they came up with was five wells and possibly a treatment plant and a storage tank, I think what you're hearing from me is just a more definitive, straight answer of what this community needs versus the ideas that were created inside of Adkins and Madhouse, because they're not any different. They're just the sources.
Let's get away from Madhouse. Let's talk about this revision or this, whatever you call this working group thing. I thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought we were coming down to the end of the analysis that, okay, here's how much water we're short.
Yes, and so if, here's the other thing. If you're looking at just a how much water are we short, that doesn't highlight anything about resiliency, meaning if you're looking just for how much volume you would be short in that condition, if you have that condition and have like what we had happen the other day where there's a main break, that highlights your resiliency. And the resiliency to this community has been pointed out in the report. It's really low and the risk is very high. And so that's what the district has to answer in a controlled.
Well, you can't analyze things by the worst case. I mean,
that's actually what we do in water.
We never build a bridge.
That's exactly what we do in water, Randy.
If you,
we plan worst case and hope for the best. So what you're saying is the exact opposite of what water actually does.
Well, then you would have to analyze what happens if the plant shuts down.
Exactly, and we do. It's part of AREIA, which is a Risk and Resiliency Infrastructure Act requirement. You actually have to do that.
How does that?
It became a requirement.
How does that relate to how much development can we do and how much water do we need?
It strictly relates to it, because what they do is they have a set amount that you're supposed to keep in storage so that in the event that it shuts down, you're able to meet those demands. But I think, so I'm going to I'm going to try to...
I don't see that anywhere in it.
Right, because they're in two separate things. Usually you have an integrated water master plan and you have an urban water management plan, and then you have your risk and resiliency assessments. You also have your emergency prepared response plans, and so all of those items are what make together what an entity does and how it plans to handle a water crisis, and we have some of that already written out. And that's why we have like Code Red and other systems, is because during those events, you're doing the best to keep the system under pressure. If the system goes out of pressure, you have to then do a boil order, and people can't drink water for almost, basically almost 96 hours. But I think we're getting too far in the. So I'm gonna try to roll it back and see if you have anything.
And I don't know how we reconcile. Okay, as board. I mean, you know, we can put five numbers up, 500, 5,000 acre feet, 4,000, 3,000, 2,000, 1,000, and pick a number. But what I think we have accomplished by doing this, and this is not an engineering study, this is an analysis of Lisa Mattis's work, okay, is, okay, we'll start with a 500 acre feet of recycled water that isn't there that they said was. We can start... We can run, you know, all kinds of analysis. We're going to have to pick a number. Okay, my contention, at least personally, and what this report says, is our number is higher than her number. It doesn't do anything about resiliency. It doesn't do anything about digging wells. It doesn't find a secondary source of supply. But somewhere along the line, we got to hang our hat on a number. And at least what we did is not hang our number on what she said. For the third time.
What are we hanging our number? What does that mean?
You're saying
in finding a solution to this problem, what does hanging our hat on a number?
You're not going to get an analysis down to an acre foot, because there's too many variables in whether the river flows or it doesn't, or how long it flows, or whether it's interrupted, or whether it's sustained drought, all these things. So the and I don't understand why you would not plan for a worst case scenario. I'm a resident here. I want the district to plan for the worst case scenario, because I can't control it completely, and I may get screwed eventually, but I want to do everything that I can to minimize the risk. Okay? So if that means inflating the number, or that means bringing the number to a level that everyone is comfortable with, that's the number I want to use. We've done it backwards.
At the end of the day, we need a solution to the problem.
What do we use that number for
when you get there?
What do we use the number for? What the number? If you know exactly how many acre feet you're short, if you need to find based on one of two scenarios, A, B, C, and H, or a full complement of villages and the 39 acres, okay, once you get that number, you know what the demand is. Demand's not an issue. We agree with Lisa Mattis. Well, we're within a couple of acre feet, a couple of 20, 30, 40, 50.
I think that's important, Randy. Yeah. I think the demand side, we did pretty good work.
Yeah, so I can speak to that if you want.
I get all that. I get everything that you said. But apparently, we're not going to figure out how many pumps we need based on this number that you're talking about. We're going to do it on resiliency and how many gallons per day we're using and the reservoir capacities.
Yeah, it's basic. That's what a water supply assessment actually does, is measure the amount of water that a community or a development needs, and it determines that amount of water. And a lot of places require that a developer bring that on as part of their development and then tie into their system. And they look at how much water they would use and whether or not they can meet it. And I can tell you they always plan more, because I can't so I can just be honest. I can't control whether you go out and wash your car in the driveway and leave the hose running. I don't have any control over that. And so that's why they do always plan for the worst. But in this situation where you're talking about adding pumps, it isn't really adding pumps. It's adding supply. And you can't do that without first doing test wells, because you don't know what you're going to get out of the well itself, out of the hole. You can drill a hole. That doesn't mean that it'll produce 1,000 gallons a minute. So you have to do the test drill first.
Understood all along. How many wells do I need if it produces X amount of gallons?
That's exactly the point. It has to depend on what that X value is. And they all do not deliver the same thing, even from
No. If I do a test well and I know how much water it's bringing up, how many wells do I need based on that information?
So I'm going to say you at least need two.
No.
At a minimum.
How do these studies and what you said about resiliency and all of that, how do we get to the solution that says, okay, these pumps bring up this much water, therefore I need X amount of pumps. I need X amount of water.
The volume of water that you need comes from what you already have in your community. It's just straight off demand. So if you look, that's what you need. You need to be able to supply enough water to meet demand. And that's where the number comes from. That would be the same in any organization. It wouldn't be like an unsolvable problem, because you're not looking at how many wells do you need. You're looking at one versus the other. And what I'm looking at is what takes care of the whole community in both situations. And having like a well or a water plant, you may be able to produce and get by. But from a risk and resiliency standpoint, which is part of an urban water management plan, you're going to be at a high risk, which they're going to want something from the board. And I would not want to live in a community where the board didn't consider that.
How does storage fit into that?
Storage always augments off of that, meaning as long as you have storage in a wet year, you don't use the wells. The wells would sit and basically be unused. Surface water, just in all essence, is a little more highly desirable. It doesn't stain. It doesn't have hard water spots.
You keep going sideways on me.
So
we're looking for a solution to this problem. We don't have enough water. And what I just heard you said was that Mattis's plan and this analysis of this plan are not going to come into the calculations of how much water we end up trying to get more of, because it's going to be totally on demand, and the
that is Mattis's plan. So Mattis, the only work that Mattis did on this was supply and demand. The rest of the work was done by Adkins, and the district itself, and I can say it, I wasn't here at the time, so I wasn't involved in any of it. There are assumptions that were made that I'm assuming that we asked on our end to be done, because that's what Adkins has relayed to me. And there are things in there that are misstated, misused, and I'm not laying blame on any one of them. I think Mattis did an excellent job at taking our consumption data and drawing that into demand, and that's exactly what I'm using. Demand comes directly from our billing system, and that shows us, and we report on it every single month to the state. That gives us a great idea or starting point of how much water we need to be able to deliver at a moment's notice using another source.
Let me come at this from a different direction. I'm just trying to understand.
Well, I can.
I'm not trying to argue. I'm just trying to understand this. So all of the assumptions you made about that you questioned about capacity and evaporation and leakage and all of those things when we come down to the solution to this problem, none of that's going to make any difference, because you're saying we just need to fit the demand or future demand. Demand or future demand. That's what I heard you say.
So we didn't change. We didn't change anything in capacity. Capacity was always there. The only thing that would change is what's allowable and what's not, which was using the flashboard. So that doesn't change. The demand didn't change. We didn't change any of those either. The only thing that changed from the assumptions were what they were using to make up water that wasn't available. They were trying to offset potable water using recycled water when there is no delivery system to even do that. They were trying to offset it with the use of Clementia, the shortage. Can't do it. And so those from a risk and resiliency and just a reporting standpoint would just be like picking a dream and saying, well, we could do this. And that'll help us in that event, even though it's not allowed. So I'm not getting through to what my question is.
Can I if you look at this from, forget about even for a moment, forget about what the water board says and what the law says about risk and resiliency and all this other stuff, which if we'd done an urban plan, okay, we would have gotten some of this stuff. We didn't do one. What we got was a really good assessment of what demand is. That's all we got. That, believe me, there's nothing worth anything in there other than the demand. But part of our problem is compounded by the fact that the real issue that we have centers around storage. Okay, forget about river interruptions for a moment. But our ability to store and retain any emergency water whatsoever is non-existent. Other than, you know, what, 750 acre feet in Clementia that is a problem to start with for a bunch of reasons, which according to the numbers we come up with and what Lisa comes up with, okay, is not even half of what we need to sustain ourselves for 1 year. So then when you talk about this resiliency stuff, okay, so what do we as a board or somebody decide? Well, we know that droughts historically don't last 1 year. They don't. They last 2 years. They last 3 years. And we slipped through the last one that nailed Folsom and nailed everybody else. That one lasted 4 years. And it happened to be on the other side of the watershed, and we got lucky. Okay, so do we plan for 3 years? Do we plan for 2 years? Do we plan for 1 year? The engineering aspects of this suggest that we find something finite, and we can't. There's too many variables in the process. And if the river ran 70 cubic feet a second every day for 365 days, we don't even need this. We could be here forever. We could build 827 houses.
Let me suggest this, John. I'm not getting my question through, and I need to rethink how to approach it to get my question understood and answered. So, and we're going around in circles.
Yeah, okay.
So let's just move on, and I will rethink.
I'll toss out one thing too.
What I'm trying to say, and I will get with Eric one-on-one.
I appreciate
and hold on 1 second. Hold on one more minute.
Mm-hmm.
You've been hanging on to the podium. I think we're trying to get to the same answer. And I understand, I think, what you want, and I think I want the same thing. At some point, forget about however you call it, and I don't even know what half these terms mean, okay? But whatever you call it, we're going to have to hang our hat on a number. And if you disagree with me, please tell me, because then maybe we don't understand.
No. We're agreed on that part. The part that's confusing me is I'm hearing two different things. It depends upon the capacity and the evaporation and the number of years of drought. And then I hear on this resiliency thing that no, the number of pumps is just going to depend upon the demand and the usage, because we're not going to pump out of the reservoirs. We're going to pump it all out of the, and this goes back to, I'm not getting my question right, but I do agree with you that yes, we need a number that says here's how much we need those wells to produce.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, so the state has some requirements that go to this, and that's why I'm talking about not just from a storage or how much can they produce, because what's required is that you meet your maximum day demand. It's MDD, it's an engineering, and so you have to be able to meet that. And that's why originally, even when they did the first well studies, they were looking for one well that would meet the full demand. The other thing that you have to meet that's outside of the maximum day demand is called the peak hour demand, and that's because almost all entities have a same cycle of pattern where there's a huge volume of water of demand. So outside of how much can a well produce in a year, that number also matters how much it can produce instantaneous, because you have to be able to meet those. That's what I'm getting at.
And whatever we do here, if we're going to put holes in the ground, they're going to produce collectively, they're going to produce X.
Right.
Okay. If we know what X is, and we've hung our hat on a number, okay? We know how much water is available to do, number one, develop an emergency source of supply. Number two, satisfy the requirements of the development. So, Janice, please.
Okay, thank you. Randy, you mentioned the fact, you said that our report changed the assumptions. And I want to make sure you understand, we didn't arbitrarily change these assumptions. We challenged the assumptions in the Integrated Water Master Plan for the following reasons. Lake Clementia, it's been assumed that we can use Lake Clementia as a source of water. We're not permitted to do it. We don't know if our water treatment plant can clear it. We don't know the quality of that water. If you build around it, you're going to reduce part of the water that comes in through drainage. It becomes urban water that's not potable water. So we took Clementia out because we do not have the right at this time to use it. And we need to find out. I mean, we apply for a permit. We try to get Clementia. We see if that's an option. But right now, today, it is not an option. And we need to deal with what we have today. We look at the recycled water. We currently don't have the supply that it's saying. And if you mathematically work it out, you'll see that those numbers don't fly. And we don't have the infrastructure in place. We don't have an analysis of how much it would cost to put that infrastructure in place. So assuming that recycled water is an option, that again is not a viable one. You look at the flashbore capacity of the reservoirs. As Eric said, the Department of Water Resources doesn't allow it. The Department of Public Health put it in writing to me. It is not an acceptable practice when planning for future development. But the study assumes we have the use of the flashbore capacity. So we know that that is also an assumption that's unachievable. Those three assumptions alone changed the results of the study by over 2,000 acre feet of water. And I want to let that sink in for a second. We don't use that much in a year. And yet those three assumptions that the CSD had Atkinson use alter the study by more than 1 year's water supply. That's why I've been fighting since 2006 for us to do a legitimate study. Does that make sense?
I heard what you said.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, sir.
I was listening to Randy, and you're saying that we need a solution to the problem, and maybe you're not prepared to say yet, but I'm not sure what is the problem you're talking about. I mean, I think we're a problem, for entitled properties, we don't have enough water. Is that the problem you're talking about, or is you talking about supplying developers for as yet to be entitled properties? I mean, I'm simply asking, what is the problem that you're talking about that we don't have a solution to?
Both. We don't have enough water for apparently resiliency for what is built, and then it is the CSD's responsibility to provide water for future development. That's the way I see it.
Okay, thank you. I just want to know what you thought it was.
That will be another debatable question. We'll leave that one alone for the time being.
May I?
You got something?
Well, just when you're ready to move on, I just need to know if this is going to the board next week for discussion, analysis, debate, or you want to sit on it, or I just looking for direction.
I think it needs to be accepted. Okay, the board needs to receive it.
Okay.
And we can, you know, have a discussion that centers around it, or we can have a plan to have a discussion that centers around it.
Okay.
I don't have that answer yet. But
okay, so I'll put it on the agenda. Yes.
But it needs to go on there. I mean, we're not going to, you know, it is what it is. It's we're
sure.
not changing it. It's,
but you want to present it.
Somebody else can do another report if they want.
Receive and file.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
It's like the draft master water plan.
Right.
Well, receive and file.
The audit's on there too for receive and file.
Okay. Anything further on this topic?
So up next, I'm not sure if Amelia, you wanted to handle this one. What we're looking to do is change, and I'll throw it over to here. I'll toss out. Just we're looking to change this policy, and Amelia will run it from here. The policy.
When we introduced and adopted this policy last year, this is the one where if there's a water main break in the village and they need to have a plumber out, we'll reimburse them because we've taken responsibility for all those pipes that are running underneath people's homes, all those main lines. And mostly I think folks are coming to us first and we're doing the work or we're having our own people come out. But we did have a $380 receipt for a plumber. And we thought that it might be a good idea to raise the limit to, we suggested $5,000 before it go to the board, because it says in here that the board's going to approve every receipt. And so if $5,000 sounds like the threshold that you would like to have this out, or if you'd like to look at every receipt, even if it's only $50, we're just trying to be respectful of the board's time.
I'm not really excited about $50 receipts.
Right. And I was here when we changed the general manager's limit from $5,000 to $25,000.
Don't even go there.
Because you guys didn't want to hear about $6,000 receipts anymore.
So put this into two sentences for me and tell me what it is we're doing and what it is you want to do.
We would like to revise the amount of a receipt that comes in for reimbursement for the village from nothing, the board wants to see every single reimbursement, to anything over $5,000.
What's your experience? How many of these have we had, and what's your experience of what the normal amount is?
So far we've had, I believe, four of them. So when I first started, I think there were three that were sitting and waiting, and I think there was a high one of close to maybe like, I think it was $3,000 or $4,000. The other ones I would say are all in the $1,500 and lower range. Typically we try to handle this by the residences that live in this area contacting us, and if we feel the work is unsafe, then we contact a contractor to come out and do the work, so that way we pay for it all up front. There are times like this one where a resident has the work done and then tries to get reimbursed from us because it's actually something that we're responsible for just due to the way those lines are constructed. Mm-hmm. And like Amelia said, we're just trying to be respectful of time, where this is like a $380 receipt for reimbursement that, you know, by all of us even discussing it, we've spent more than that getting it reimbursed.
So what do you suggest? I don't know.
She has $5,000.
Yeah, but I mean, is that a good number? I don't know.
Well, it must be if you put it in there. Then I'm good with it.
$5,000?
Then I'm good with it, too.
Okay. I'll move this to the board. Which will take us right on to the next
So basically, the next item was basically just for the reimbursement. So if you'd like to approve this, that we move it forward to the board so they can get reimbursed, that would be great.
Yeah, you're okay with that, right?
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Is that the end of your list?
No, I think we
not
have.
Not quite.
I think we have a couple more. Let me.
Okay.
All right, so now we're going to get into vehicle purchases. So this is part of the capital improvement plan. We did lose one vehicle due to an accident. It was totaled. As part of the capital improvement plan, we built in for sewer for $25,000 from sewer, $25,000 from water to purchase a new vehicle. So these are the quotes to purchase the new vehicles. As you can see, if you scroll through and take a look, we would buy the one that's the best cost. We're hoping for the one that's the F-250. It fits our needs more than anything else. There's also a vehicle quote in here for the F-150 Lightning, which is the electric vehicle. At this time, we don't feel that that's necessary because our life cycle we would be replacing this vehicle prior to being required to have all electric. Also with the electric, there becomes a lot more concerns with liability, longevity, also taking care of them. Insurance costs are higher. A small accident can destroy them because if the batteries become damaged. Also, we don't have the infrastructure to charge, but this is the board's discretion, so we have it here for discussion.
No, I'm fine with a gasoline vehicle.
Okay.
Randy is. Yep.
So the quote from Downtown Ford is the one that will move forward. And then how...
And I believe it actually even got cheaper because I know that I've been in conversations with our new utility supervisor, and he said the cost dropped a little bit, so he was hoping to move on it. So hopefully we'll be able to move on it. And they're going to look at having a... It's a valve turn. A valve turner. So a lot of people don't know what a valve turning appurtenance is, but they fix it basically to the truck, and you go out and turn the valves in your system. It's actually a requirement when you go beyond 3,000 connections. The state wants to know how many valves you turn a year, because in, like we're talking about risk and resiliency, in the fact that there's an emergency, you want to be able to close those valves so that you don't impact a bunch of homes. And so you're supposed to be turning those valves, which keeps them the lifespan of them a lot better. And so they're wanting to pick up this vehicle so that they can get a mounted one to that truck, and then they would start turning valves, and you use software to track it. It does it by GIS, so you can see.
So what you're saying here is you think that the vehicle at Downtown Ford is the one
yes.
you want to buy?
Yes.
I'm okay. Randy?
Yep.
We'll move that to the board. Thank you.
Okay.
Right, and this brings us to the conversation over automated meter infrastructure. And so I did want to tell everybody that I did plagiarize an old staff report on this one. I used the previous one that was for another vendor, but I added in the sections that are most pertinent. So we've been doing some evaluating now for over a year on what it would take to get AMI, we'll call it that, just to shorten it up. What that would allow us to do is to have the meters read by no labor hours. It would talk through a radio frequency to a radio tower. That radio tower would talk to headquarters. The meters would be basically read virtually, I guess you could say it. And then it would also sometimes generate reports of meters that aren't communicating. So if there's a meter that doesn't communicate, you'd get a zero read list, and our staff would go out and check the zero reads. Our current vendor that we use is Aquametric. Aquametric purchased up Sensus technology a while ago. And so there's a quote in here from, there's actually three quotes in here, but there's a quote in here from them to get in place what we need to get moving forward with AMI. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing, is because the first quote basically builds what we need for infrastructure, which I believe, if it's the right one, it's about $164,000. It's a radio tower. That radio tower is what they've already done a study. It would basically be put it, I believe Rio Oso was the site of the original study. That would allow all of the meters to talk to it. The other two quotes, one is if we took every endpoint, and the endpoint sits inside the meter box, and what it does is talk to that radio tower. If we took them all and turned them all in and replaced them, they would give us that dollar amount. And then we would use that to offset the cost of purchasing all brand new endpoints. I'm recommending against that methodology because by doing so, you're basically replacing the whole entire system at once, which leads all your point of failures to one exact time. And so what I would like to do is do the tower and then do a methodical. So the reason it says $200,000 is we budgeted for $250,000. What I would like to do is do the tower and then do the endpoints basically like in three phases over like a set amount of time so that they're not all done at the same exact time. That will require staff to still do drive-by of certain areas. But it'll get us moving in the right direction. It'll also help us be able to see what happens when we convert over so that we don't basically do a hard start on the whole community and have a ton of issues all at once. And so we would do an implemented phased approach. And so that's why what I want to move forward is basically we stay with the $250,000, but we use the quote to do the tower and the infrastructure for it, which some of it is licensing and software. And then we do endpoints as we see fit to eat up the rest of that amount. And if we carry over to the next following year, we'd give the board a number of how many have been replaced. Currently, the number that we've heard needs replaced from our vendor is about 1,900 endpoints. So that's over half the meters that we have out there. I just don't want to do it all at once. Also, it creates a lot of stir in the community where people feel like they're being feel like they're almost being inappropriately billed. So I just want to do segments so that we can allow to see how that roll out, like a soft rollout, basically.
Was this when we did the budget and the CIP, this was in there?
Yes, it's $250,000 on the CIP. I made sure to have a little bit of room with it. I think maybe it might even be $225,000. I wanted some room just in case because I was using the old quote. And I kind of glossed over the staff report. Previously, what was being requested of the board or the district was looking to do was replace all of the meters and go to a completely new company and to have that go to AMI. And the cost of doing that was about $1.6 million. And so this is only about $165,000. And I think at full build out, you're looking at closer to maybe $300,000 or $400,000. So it's at 75% reduction from what we were originally looking at. So I think it's a great cost savings as well.
And I'm assuming then that how do we control, for example, we're then going to, obviously, I hope, like, for example, in the residences, we're gonna place a meter or require a meter or get paid for a meter that is consistent with what you're talking about here.
Yeah, so all the meters out there are already this way. They're census meters, and so they would talk. And the newer ones that we've been purchasing already come with this endpoint. It's the old existing ones, and the endpoint really isn't a piece. It attaches to the meter, and all it allows it to do is talk. So basically, it'd be like attaching a modem to a computer, and that's the endpoint itself. So when we go out and switch the endpoints, we wouldn't be replacing your meter. You're just unplugging one endpoint and taking it off and putting a new one on that talks a further distance. The one that currently allows for drive-by does not talk far enough to be able to reach the tower.
And then our staff is who's going to be actually doing?
Yes, they would do all the endpoint replacements themselves. They already do. We currently replace them. We currently replace the meters if needed. The staff that would be needed as part of the quote that is being shown here would be for the tower, the software, and Census Aquametrics would come out and do that. And they've already been here kind of helping us as we were transitioning with a new utility supervisor and working on some of our control technology. This is a great feature for the district. It's a time saver. It saves labor. We won't have to be doing drive-by reads. They'll only be out if the meter has an issue to check on it.
And is there something in here that if it's not functioning, you're going to get a flag, or is that still the same manual process?
Nope. It'll automatically, so if when it does a download, it'll do the download on its own. It wouldn't be required of staff to set a date. It should automatically be built into a billing cycle. Anything that's called a zero read or a malfunctioning meter would throw a flag, and then staff would, there'd be a report generated, and then staff would go out and check on those prior to billing to try to manually read them, fix them, and get it into the billing before the bills go out.
So in moving this forward, you want the one invoice?
Yes. So what I really want approved is this one right here for the $165,000. The other ones, I'd like to leave them out because I don't want to rip out every single endpoint, and I don't want to replace them all at once. I want to just do it methodically, but I wanted to bring it forward as discussion because ultimately it's your decision. This isn't like a operational or a state type issue where my licenses would be at risk. This is literally just a process control, and that's up to the board at your guys' discretion.
And then we'll have that ongoing $20,000 software fee.
Yes, we already have the fee. I don't think this is a new one. I don't think this is new software because we already pay the license for Census.
Okay.
And I could check into that to find out for sure once we get it. But it may be depending on how that tower speaks to us, but I don't think it is because we already have their software.
We're already paying for that.
Yeah.
And where does the tower get built?
My understanding is that the first site they did the study was Rio Oso, and I think I don't even know that they may build it there, or it may just be an attachment that goes on to the tank there.
To the tank.
Yeah. Yeah, because a lot of it is line of sight, so the higher they can get it, the better off it functions. And my understanding is when they did the original radio study that everything talks. It's not hilly or valley enough that we lose areas, so we only needed one tower, not a multitude of towers.
Okay. You good with moving it on? Okay.
Makes sense.
I will move that to the board. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay.
Next
page. All right. And the last item we have on the list is basically a request to do out-of-state training. It was in my understanding going through some of the policies that out-of-state training has to be approved by the board. And so there was a request by the chief plant operator to do membrane training, and that training was in Colorado. And so this is a request here to send them to that training. This is the cost of the training itself. It doesn't include the cost of travel or the hotel or the stay. That would be added extra, but this is just, that's the policy. So that's why we're here with this one.
Yeah, and that would be consistent. You know, we've talked about with Cassell, there's a couple of options for training with the new accounting system that we send them to Salt Lake or, you know, and get it all done, or we do it piecemeal here and that. So I don't have any problem with that.
Nope. I'm good with it.
Okay.
That's all I have.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
I think that's it, is it not?
Let's find out. Director comments.
I'm done.
No, I have nothing.
Okay. With that, then we will adjourn at 9:47.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.